My talk this morning comes out of a convergence of several different phenomena that I have studied and tried to take a look at over the last few years. I've basically been an Americanist through most of my career studying American religious groups, but during the 90s have had a particular opening to begin to look at the changing situation in Europe, particularly after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So I have taken that opportunity, and now I'm doing most of my work in other parts of the world rather than in America. I've also been deeply involved in religious freedom and religious liberty issues, and the issue of anti-cultism has come up continually. And also have a number of Mormon scholar friends who, with whom I share an interest in the history of anti-Mormonism and how that has worked. And of late, I have been trying to write a history of modern anti-cultism. Anti-cultism, as we know it today, is a relatively new phenomenon. It's actually grew up during and immediately after World War II, but it has its roots in some older kinds of phenomena of reactionary movements against what are seen as people who are on the edge or are perceived as a threat to contemporary culture. The Mormon movement, of course, has experienced both of the two major kinds of anti-cultism through its history. One is the kind we call Christian counter-cult activities. These are activities basically kind of interreligious polemics where one religious group in power attacks another religious group perceived of less power and tries to use its general influence in the culture to argue for its own truth values and the untruth of the other religion. And then there is the more insidious and harmful kind of secular anti-cultism, in which a particular religious group, or even some cases non-religious groups, are pinpointed by people in political authority and with some kind of cultural secular power as being a threat to the general welfare of the culture. Say both of these forms of activity have existed almost throughout human history. You can see examples of it in first century BC in Egypt, for example, where the Jews were attacked this way. But it has become very much a part of our life today as pluralism has developed. I was interested as I came in this morning of seeing one book with that subtitle about the Mormon flight from American pluralism. Whatever that flight was in previous generations, there is no place to run from it anymore. Pluralism is a fact of life. Right now, London vies with Los Angeles as the most pluralistic city in the world religiously. I tend to think that it is more pluralistic than Los Angeles, and I think we will have the data to prove that within the next year or two. But the other capital cities of the world, whether you go to Tokyo or Nairobi or Johannesburg or Moscow, what have you, are all home to the same kinds of spectrum of religious phenomena that we have known to love and live with here in Southern California. What we call anti-cultism was really, today what we call anti-cultism, really a unique product of America in the years of World War II. By the time World War II was well into happening, there was a movement in America that had kind of spent its wad. It was called fundamentalism. Remember, back in the 20s and 30s, fundamentalist groups had created quite an issue within the major denominations. During the 1930s, the fundamentalists plainly aware that they had lost. They had lost control of the denominations. They had lost control of the seminaries. They had lost control of the mission field. And so a decision was presented to them. What shall we do? And it divided the movement in the 30s as groups of fundamentalists pulled out of the major denominations and formed a number of small fundamentalist organizations. We know them today as the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, the Bible Presbyterian Church, the General Association of Regular Baptists, the number of groups. They all measure their membership in the tens of thousands. Very few of them have made it as much as 100,000 members. The rest of the people, and generally the older minister leaders who are well ensconced into denominational programs, particularly the pension program, stayed in the denominations and tried to work within them. By the end of the 30s, some new coalitions were forming between those former fundamentalist leaders still in their denomination and some of the fundamentalist leaders who had left their denomination but who still wanted to see themselves as part of the culture. And there was an immediate problem. They had lost control of all of the seminaries. If you were of a conservative theological bent, where did you go to school? All of the Northern Baptist and all of the Presbyterian seminaries were now run by raving modernists. And if you went there as a fundamentalist, your views would be derided, and you would be talked out of it. So what is born at the beginning of the 40s and manifests itself very particularly during World War II and comes out of World War II as a strong movement is a new force we call evangelicalism. The evangelicals came out very boundary conscious because of their situation. They were in the large liberal denominations, but they did not want to be thought of as liberals. They had on the other side of them were all of these fundamentalists who had left their denominations and were calling for them to separate from their liberal brethren and were kind of anti-learning. They were anti-modern. They were anti-everything that was going on in the church, in religion in general. So the evangelicals became boundary conscious. On the one hand, they wanted to separate themselves from the liberals but stay in the mainline churches. On the other hand, they wanted to separate themselves from the people who still thought of themselves as fundamentalist and carrying on that battle that had plainly been lost and who, as time goes on today, the number of fundamentalists is down to just a margin. They have access almost to nothing anymore. The evangelicals have kind of won out and become a new force in American religion. They conservative, so they had to begin a movement. They were very fortunate because almost immediately there emerged a star among them by the name of Billy Graham. And he became kind of a rallying point. They were able to obtain a large grant of money from a man named Charles Fuller, who many of us don't remember anymore, but he was very popular on the radio during the early and mid part of this century. And Charles Fuller gave the money to found Fuller Theological Seminary, an independent Presbyterian seminary to which evangelical ministers could go for training, and which was plainly in the Baptist, Presbyterian, Congregational, Theological perspective, but traditionalist in approach, but staffed by very fine scholars so that people who came out of that school could go into mainline church positions and hold down the more conservative churches. They also, at this point, become very concerned because they are the group who are most aware of American pluralism. They are victims of it. In effect. And so it is out of evangelicalism that the counter-cult movement is born. And it's born on the shoulders of a young Baptist minister by the name of Walter Martin. Walter Martin created Christian counter-cultism. And almost all of the forces of counter-cult movements today are made up of Walter Martin's students. There are literally hundreds of them. Some of them formally trained during the years that Martin became a seminary professor, but most of them just informally trained. There are very few scholars in this movement, a number of pastors, but very few with PhDs. But most of them just simply got Walter Martin's books, which were the only things available in the 1950s, and learned their anti-cultism from him. And because of Martin's peculiar relationship to the Mormon movement, a relationship which has many avenues of controversy about it, anti-Mormonism became one of the major themes of the counter-cult movement. There was also another and more important reason why anti-Mormonism became such an important part of anti-cultism is because Mormons were successful, much more successful than most other non-conventional religions. In the United States, you can go to anywhere in the country and find Mormons. You can go anywhere and find Jehovah's Witnesses, but you cannot go anywhere and find Moonies. You cannot go just anywhere and find Hare Krishna. You cannot go just anywhere and find 9 out of 10 of all of the non-conventional religions in America. As a matter of fact, you can take all of the non-conventional religions in America and put them in one room, and take all of the Mormons and put them in the other room, and the Mormon room will be 3 times as big. And that's the way it is. And thus, out of 400 anti-cult organizations in the United States today, 200 of those are devoted exclusively to fighting Mormonism. Another 100 of them are devoted exclusively to fighting Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses. And then there's the others. So it is out of this kind of evangelical worldview that counter-cult activities are born. Then something significant happens in 1963, and this has significance for the whole of the United States and Europe. In 1963... Democratic government is trying to play politics in Southeast Asia. The Southeast Asians say, we will play politics, but only if you cut out these discriminatory laws against us in your country, meaning immigration laws. So in 1965, a new immigration bill was finally pushed through that opened up all of the Asian countries to immigration to the United States. We had blocked that immigration in 1924 pretty thoroughly. This brought into the country, all of a sudden, a whole bunch of new religions. Prabhupada, the head of Hare Krishna, was actually the first person who took advantage of this. He had come to the United States in the summer of 65 on a tourist visa. The law changed while he was here, and he was able to stay in this country and build his movement. Other leaders soon followed, and all of a sudden, particularly here on the West Coast, we had where most of the Asian immigrants settled, we had a wave of new religions happening. It was in response to that that a number of parents, particularly parents of middle-class kids whose hopes for their son's professional upward mobility and their daughter's marriage into to one of these people who was upwardly mobile, were dashed to the grounds that the new anti-cult movement started. It was a grassroots family reaction to what was going on. And the major groups that were targeted were those groups that had decided that the best way to build a movement is to recruit leaders. And so they went out not just recruiting members, but they were recruiting leadership. They didn't care about building congregations that much. What they cared about was building a committed core of potential leaders who would, in our day now, start to build congregations. So that when people converted to the Moonies and to the Hare Krishna and to similar movements, they were not just converting to go to a different church on Sunday. They were converting their whole life. To become workers, and this was to be their occupation. Now, I know of no middle-class parent in the 1950s who would be able to stand up and say, I raised my son to be a missionary for the Unification Church. It was just something that was devastating to a lot of people. But out of this grows up a very frustrated lot of people. If you can imagine the situation in the early 1970s, I'm trying to get my son out of the Moonies, and the culture is just not helping me. Well, if they want to join the Moonies, okay. What's your problem? You don't like it, but it's their choice. They begin to look for people to help them. And the majority of the help came from people in the psychological professions. They went to psychological counselors. Psychological counselors sympathized with them. And slowly, through the 1970s, built up a rationale for why these people should not join these groups and why these groups were actually dangerous. We know it as brainwashing theory today. That these the idea was built up that the people who converted to these groups were vulnerable, passive people who had been preyed upon by terrifically manipulative organizational leaders and had been forced into conversion. Now, as Armand was talking about in the early hour, it doesn't work that way. We actually know that overwhelmingly the people who joined these groups were seekers. They were not passive. They had actively been out seeking for a new religion. And most of them had been to two or three other groups before they found the one that they eventually joined. And we know that the ones who stayed with a group were the ones who got actively involved in their own conversion process and found not only a new worldview, but a new fellowship and a new social arrangement along those lines. The problems with all of the anti-cult movement in the 1970s were vividly demonstrated after Jonestown. Here was the opportunity to make headway, but they were unable to do it because they couldn't agree on anything. They couldn't agree on an organization. They couldn't agree on a leader. They couldn't agree on who was going to publish a newsletter. Nothing worked. And out of Jonestown, in the 2 years that followed it, out of their despair over being able to seize the moment, the Cult Awareness Network was formed. It was originally known as the Citizens Freedom Foundation. It was the California anti-cult group grown large. Between 1983 and 1987, the cult awareness organization adopted what they called a five-year plan to build an effective national organization to fight cults. And they did that. Did it pretty well. They set up an office in Chicago. And they drove the parents out of leadership. The professionals took over. Those professional leaders, mostly psychologists, a few lawyers, a handful of ministers from mainline denominations, a few rabbis, seized the organization and took it over because they knew how to run a national organization. And also because by this time parents had pretty much lost interest. It had been 15 years since their child had converted, and they had either reconciled themselves to that fact or had given up pretty much. So that by 1987, they were no longer running things. If you looked at the board of the two main organizations, there were no parents there. It was all professionals who had taken it over, and they have run the movement ever since. And it is these professionals who found their leader in a woman by the name of Margaret Singer, who's a psychologist from Berkeley, who spread anti-cultism to Europe. Anti-cultism was an American product, and it was exported to Europe. It was not something Europeans thought of before the movement got going here. But it was exported first to England and then to France. And here in each of these countries, it gained some stature and found an audience. In France, it one member of the House of Lords, a fellow we know affectionately as Lord Rodney, became enthused about it and opened up Parliament to various anti-cult meetings, and has continually tried to pass good anti-cult legislation passed in England. In France, it really got tied to right-wing politics, and some of the most conservative right-wing elements in Paris became involved in anti-cultism, and this does much to explain what is happening right now. But several organizations were set up in England, several in France, and from England and France it spread to different other countries of Europe, particularly to Spain, where an organization was set up in the early 80s in Spain, and that organization has now led to organizations spreading all over South America and all of the South American anti-cult groups that you can run into happen there. Well, meanwhile, as the organization, anti-cultism, is being set up here, plans are underway in this country to destroy the anti-cult movement. The first thing that happens is that all of the ideas about brainwashing get thrown into the debate mix at professional conferences. The American Psychological Association, the American Sociological Association, the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. And during the early 80s, these ideas are discussed in great depth. And a consensus is reached that brainwashing theory as applied to religious conversion is a lot of garbage. They were pretty well tossed out. But they continued to be talked about and debated. Meanwhile, a series of court cases were happening in which large sums of money was being awarded to various individuals who sued non-conventional religions. Multi-million dollar judgments against the Krishnas, the Scientologists, the Moonies in particular. Finally, someone has the idea of let's bring the APA into all of this. So, sure enough, someone went to the American Psychological Association, would you prepare a friend of the court brief concerning a particular case? It happened to be a case with the Unification Church. They prepared one, and then someone pointed out to them that, no, Dr. Singer has been asked to prepare a whole report on this with a committee to bring her theories in their best form to the APA. And we cannot participate in this court case until we've reviewed our own committee's work. So they withdrew their friend of the court brief, and short time after that, the Dr. Singer's committee report was presented. Not surprisingly, that report was turned down unanimously. It was turned down on the grounds of the fact that it was poor methodologically. There was no evidence, empirical evidence, to support the theory, and the work was just plain sloppy, to put it bluntly. It was a very short letter was written by the APA leadership to Dr. Singer and the members of the committee saying, this report has been turned down. The turn down was unanimous, and you cannot use your participation on preparing this report to credential yourself in the future. By that point, the Mooney case that had caused all of this to be raised had got settled out of court. It turned out that the people who were suing the church had been caught in a very significant lie. So they settled very quickly once that was pointed out to them. But another case came up immediately in which a man by the name of Fishman, who had been caught doing some illegal things, was pleading that he was innocent on the grounds that he did these things while he was a member of the Church of Scientology, and the Church of Scientology brainwashing was the real reason he had committed these illegal acts. Okay, this was an honest argument that was put forward by Mr. Fishman. It was in this case, then, that the full impact of the APA report was presented to the court. The court tossed out all of the brainwashing testimony, and that tossing out edict was published, and became precedent, and in two more cases within 2 years, the same people, Dr. Singer and a sociologist by the name of Richard Offshee, were both tossed out of court again. Three times they got tossed out of court. They were gone. They were history. Brainwashing was history, and you could no longer go into court and argue brainwashing, at least in this country, and get away with it. The people who you needed to support that could no longer speak in court. So, Singer and Offshee file suit against the APA, charging first in federal court racketeering, and then later in California state court conspiracy to destroy their careers. Now, it took 5 years to adjudicate those cases, but in the end, both cases were tossed out of court with prejudice. And in the second case, which was just decided last fall, the final papers were signed last fall, it not only was tossed out with prejudice, but Dr. Singer and Offshee had to pay all the legal fees for the people that they sued. That has nailed the lid to the coffin on brainwashing theory in this country. And along with that, within 3 months of everything began to unravel for the anti-cult movement in this country. Within a month of the final signing of those documents, there was the Scott decision that came out of the state of Washington. A man named Scott, who was a member of a mainline Pentecostal church, the United Pentecostal Church, had been kidnapped in the attempt to deprogram him by a couple of deprogrammers who work with CAN. He sued. He won $5 million. $1 million of that was assessed against the Cult Awareness Network. That is going through a set of appeals right now, but we expect the Cult Awareness Network any moment to be moved into Chapter 11, and as soon as they are moved into Chapter 11 bankruptcy, they're out the door, because the lawyer in this case is a bulldog, and after the ruling on the Chapter 11 happens, he's going to be sitting on their front door claiming every possession they ever have, including their bank account. The third thing that happened was the family case in England. A group that we used to know as the Children of God, who is now known as the Family, had been sued in England. It was a simple case of custody of child. A grandmother sued for the custody of a grandson, the mother being a member of the family. Well, it turned into a 3-year examination of the family. The important thing that happened is that very early in the process, the judge ruled that brainwashing testimony was irrelevant. So the Cult Awareness Network was cut out of the process, the British part of it. And in the end, the family won. Now, several million dollars had been spent by the anti-cult movement in order to pursue this case. And when they lost big. Because it also meant the end of similar cases in Argentina, in Spain, and in France, and Australia, to boot. So anti-cultism was on its way out in the English-speaking world. And it looked like anti-cultism was on its way out everywhere else. But then all of a sudden, two events happened. One was the AUM gassing in Japan, the group that, it's been almost a year ago now, it was about a year ago, released some nerve gas in Tokyo subway. Devastating event that happened. If you know the Tokyo train station, or train system, Tokyo lives by its trains. And in the main station, the three main trains interconnect. That's where the gas was released. It was put on the train so that as it pulled into that station, the gas would pour off of that train and fill the station. If they had not been so incompetent, it might have worked. But even as incompetent as they were, 12 people died. It has a great deal of importance because the overwhelming majority of the group's members were in Russia. That's actually where they got the gas. They didn't make the gas. They bought it from a former KGB agent. And that's why you read in the paper a Russian form of nerve gas. It was actually nerve gas that was probably made in the 40s and was stolen by a KGB agent when after the Soviet Union fell apart and the KGB was largely dismantled. And some KGB agent walked out with the nerve gas in their pocket, sold it to the OM to raise a little money to survive on in post-Gorbachev Russia. The second was the Solar Temple. Now, the Solar Temple didn't happen in Switzerland, but it happened in French-speaking Switzerland. And the majority of members were from Quebec, but enough were from France that the Solar Temple thing kind of swept that whole French-speaking corridor from Geneva to Brussels and was particularly an event in Paris. So this brings us to the kind of present situation. The anti-cult movement and a lot of professionals whose income depends on it has been dismantled in this country. We haven't, for example, in this country, we haven't had a deprogramming since the Scott case. We put a whole set of people out of business in that sense. There are no more court cases for people to testify in, and that has put a whole other set of people out of business. But Europe has provided an opening, and the particularly the two incidents with the Solar Temple has provided an opening. Now, what's the situation in Europe? Well, it's very much like ours, and the Europeans have finally understood that. All through the 80s, every time we'd go to a conference in Europe, we would argue, why are you looking at America? You have the same phenomena going on here. It's older. It goes back to 48, not to 65. The only difference is that here it got caught up in the baby boom and became a big issue. Everybody knew about it. In Europe, same thing. Same kind of pluralism that's going on. You've got the same hundreds of groups here. Look at them. Well, they've started doing that. Now, and they are quite aware that this is no longer an American phenomenon. And they have become just as concerned as we were in the 1980s about what was going on. But they also have a slightly different feel for things. Think for a minute of the European situation. In every country of Europe, with one exception, the second largest religious group in the country is the Jehovah's Witnesses. In France, it's the Catholic Church, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and everybody else. In Denmark, it's the Lutheran Church, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and everybody else. The peculiar country is Switzerland. And Switzerland is peculiar because the country is kind of half-reformed, half-Catholic. And there was a schismatic group called the Old Catholics that were very, very strong in parts of Switzerland. So in Switzerland, you have this peculiar situation. There are the Catholics, there are the Reformed, there are the Old Catholics, kind of three big groups. Number four is not the Jehovah's Witnesses, it's a Swiss schism of the Jehovah's Witnesses that took them all out in the 30s. The Jehovah's Witnesses are very small in Switzerland, but it's their schism that is the big thing. So the target in Europe are the Witnesses, because they are monstrously big and monstrously effective. They came out when Tito fell in Yugoslavia. Within a year, they were openly number two all through the nations of the former Yugoslavia. They had been proselytizing in Eastern Europe quietly. They are number two in all of Eastern Europe. And they're heading that way in Russia. They're still four or five in Russia. That's part of it. All of the other groups are there. The Mormons in Europe are one among many. Nowhere in Europe do the Mormons have the kind of stature that they have in the United States, even in the eastern United States. They are not seen as something that's everywhere. They are very scattered and very, very small. Thus it is in this current wave of anti-cultism that really began on the heels of the OM event and the Solar Temple for it. Mormonism is kind of lumped in with all of the rest of the groups. Now, to show you just kind of how interesting it is that the three groups that are mentioned first on the list of anti-cult groups in the current French situation are the Mormons, the Seventh-day Adventists, and the Southern Baptists. I mean, if you can imagine, when this report came out, the President of France happened to be in the United States, and I called up one of my reporter friends in Washington, the Washington Times, and I said, you know, you need to get to this press conference, and you need to ask him if he agrees that the President of the United States, the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and most of the members of the Waco Committee who examined the cult in Texas are themselves secret cultists. That your government has said their church is a cult. Therefore, you should ask him this question very pointedly and very openly. That did not happen, but it was kind of a thing. Anyway, in the wake of the first Solar Temple event, the French Parliament published established a commission on cults. Now, in France, the word for cults is sex. S-E-C-T-E-S is in most of Europe and in Latin America, the word that's equivalent to our word cult is the word sect. We have a different meaning for the word sect here. So it was the French Commission on Sex that was set up. That committee reported in January. Now, with all of the other things that were happening, most of us just simply overlooked that this committee had been formed at all. So it wasn't until the report was published in January that all of us became aware of what had happened. We did this because we were looking at Switzerland. What is Switzerland doing about these deaths? Well, Switzerland was being very rational. They had an investigation. They brought in their top sociologist scholar of new religions, who happened to be working for Army Intelligence at the time, put him to work on the case to interpret it. It's been fine. Yeah, they treated it as a criminal matter and have dealt with it. And they have done the major demythologizing of all of the newspaper reports that came out afterwards about gun running and money laundering and all this kind of thing. But the French didn't deal with it that way. What they did is the French Commission aligned itself with ADFI, the Cult Awareness Network group in Paris, and produced about a 100-page report. It includes a laundry list of all of the new religions in France, including the Pentecostals, including the Adventists, including the Mormons, including the Baptists, which are all seen as one set of un-French-like groups that are operating in the country, and has accused them of a whole set of things. So here are what the Mormons are doing. The Mormons are contributing to the mental destabilization of those people who affiliate with it. The Mormons are making unrighteous financial demands upon their members with such things as tithing. The Mormons are disrupting the social environment of the neighborhoods in which they are operating. They are recruiting minors to their cause. They are disturbing the peace. They are committing antisocial acts. They are disturbing the economy, and they are infiltrating the public sector so that members of these groups are actually participating in politics, running for office, i.e. trying to take over the French government. I mean, that sounds silly, but that forms 25 pages of this report is detailing all of the things that all of the new religions are doing. And in each case, one or two groups are cited, one or two particular examples are cited, but the clear implication is that all of the groups are doing this, that this is what is happening, this is the image that is being perpetrated. Then the last half of the French report really is a call for action. it calls for a number of very particular actions which are of some significance. One, it calls for the establishment by the government of a major cult information center, which can begin to compile dossiers on each of the cults and which will receive reports of all of their wrongdoings. I should add that in the midst of all of this, someone, and to show you where this is all heading, is that someone discovered or was able to obtain the list of clients of the law firm, which, among other things, handles the business affairs of the Jehovah's Witnesses in Paris, and got on the phone and called every client that this particular law firm had and said, "Do you know that your clients are the Jehovah's Witnesses lawyers? We think you should drop them as your lawyers." It backfired, as it turned out, because what happened is it turned a group of rather staid lawyers who were merely handling corporate law matters for the Jehovah's Witnesses into human rights advocates who have now come out with gloves on both hands, ready to fight whoever ever for their clients. So it's turned them into very potent activists. Anyway, the second thing that the report asks for is for the government to support a rather full-scale propaganda program in the public schools to teach all of the children of France all of the evils of joining one of these cults. Thirdly, a program to train civil employees in key positions about the dangers of cults so that they can do whatever they can to fight their presence in the country. To selectively enforce all of the present laws that are on the books, which can be used against the cults. This is a tactic that has been used very, very effectively here with various kinds of zoning laws, various kinds of public laws. In other words, if you run a building like this, you've got all kinds of inspectors, fire marshals, building inspectors, plumbing, all kinds of regulations you have to play with. And what happens is, you know, you have to deal with that. No building is perfect. So if you are operating a church building and somebody starts selectively applying those laws very stiffly, they can put you out of business very quickly. That's the kind of thing it calls for. Secondly, to increase judicial actions. The report noted that there have been hundreds and hundreds of complaints against the various new religions, and very few of them were pursued. It did not suggest that the possibility was that most of those complaints were baseless, and that the ones that were pursued went in favor of the groups because there was not a sufficient case to rule against them. But they said, no, what we must do is take all of these complaints seriously, and we must pursue them and use them against the groups. One of the things that's not stated here is that you can bankrupt some of the smaller groups simply by putting them through too many judicial proceedings because of the legal fees that are required. It asked for disincorporation whenever there was anything found wrong with any of the groups. And finally, it called for the mobilization of international anti-cult support. In fact, that was what was happening while this commission was acting. As their findings were made and their opinions reached, they were sending these reports out to other governments. This report was published in January of this year. Within a month, the substance of this report appeared as a piece of legislation in the European Parliament in Brussels. Several weeks later, well, actually just about 2 weeks ago, it appeared as a set of legislation in the Belgian Parliament. It has cropped up as a set of legislation in the Austrian Parliament. Prior to this, last year, some legislation popped up in Sweden, which in effect would have designated anyone who was a member of any of the cults, including the Mormons, as mentally unstable. Simply, the only criteria for designating them mentally unstable is that they had joined one of these groups. And hence, they were immediately open to action by their family to move them into a mental institution or put them under psychiatric care. That legislation was fortunately defeated But it happened. So what we are dealing with at the moment is a broad set of anti-cult legislation, which has its origin in France, but has by the conservative wing of the government to the other nations of the new common market nations. The action of the European Parliament would not be binding on any country, but it would certainly be suggestive of what is binding and would support this kind of legislation throughout Europe. Once the French report was published and we got it translated and were able to understand what was going on, it was very, very fortunate that within 2 weeks there was a gathering of new religion scholars in France. It was a fortuitous circumstance. Massimo Intervigna, who many of you know because he has appeared at a number of Mormon History Association meetings and the Sunstone meetings, went to that conference and organized the French scholars and got them for the first time as a group to make a public statement about anti-cultism. They came out against this report. He went to the Catholic, to the archdiocese offices and was able to persuade the Archbishop of Paris and a group of the Catholic bishops to publish a statement condemning the report. In the meantime, the right-wing newspaper in Paris not only published the laundry list of all of the groups, but their addresses. Yeah. Along with their news coverage of this, they published this. The next morning at 3 a.m., the Unification Church headquarters were bombed. In other words, it was an open invitation. It was open season on the cults in France. But then the bishop's letter came out, and the French... the French sociologists of new religions came out opposing the report. The Friday after the French sociologist statement came out on Tuesday, and it was covered in the press, the commission was to present their report to Parliament. They went to Parliament. No one was home. Absolutely no one showed up to receive their report. So they spoke and presented their report to largely an empty house. They were the only ones there. The report was received by the Prime Minister, and as a result of the kind of turnaround in the public coverage of this that Massimo organized, the only thing that was done in reaction to the report is that a small office to receive information was created with an 800 line, but only one person was assigned to it. So none of the active kinds of things, the propaganda reports or the instruction to the judiciary or the use of the legal system have been implemented. So now the problems in Europe have shifted to Belgium, to Brussels, where both the Belgian Parliament and the European Parliament are still considering that legislation, and the activities have moved on to that part of what's happening, and it will shift very quickly as the legislation works its way through the judicial process in Austria, and we are currently watching to see what other kinds of legislation may pop up in the other countries of the common market. This is the kind of situation which pluralism has created. We went through our basic trauma in this country in the 1980s and are slowly learning to live with the heightened pluralism that's a part of this country. Canada, much same way, they went along pretty much paralleling us. But Europe right now is going through the trauma that we went through in the 1980s, and we expect that the rest of this century is going to be spent dealing with those issues in Europe, and heaven help us if there are any more Wacos and solar temples and alms that we have to deal with. Also, this is a little off the subject, but there's a whole set of legislation that has come down in Russia and in the Ukraine out of the alms situation. The alms situation is being used in the power play between the Catholics and the Orthodox to gain power. Immediately after the Berlin Wall fell, literally hundreds of groups moved into Russia and the Ukraine. Literally within 3 years of the fall of the Berlin Wall, 40 million Bibles have been distributed in Russia. One for every one Bible for every five citizens. Now that was by 92. I don't know what it's up to by now, but the goal was to print a Bible and put it in the hands of every Russian before the end of the century. I think that will be accomplished. Russian television was hungry for sponsors. They allowed Christian groups, Pat Robertson, for example, to buy time on main primetime programming every night for an hour all across Russia. You could get Pat Roberts for an hour. So you begin to get this reaction. The thing that staved off the reaction in Russia is the fight between the Catholics and the Orthodox for power. Is that fortunately they put much more energy into fighting each other than they have into fighting all the new groups. They're both agreed that American evangelicals and cults and other things are bad for Russia. But at the same time, there's a lot of property at stake. Who's going to get the property? Particularly outside of Russia proper in the other nations of the Commonwealth of independent states. But slowly that's being resolved, and we're going to see a backlash between the with the openings that this has occurred, because Moscow now, Kiev, St. Petersburg, all have the same groups operating there that we know and love. So let me stop there. I don't know how much time it took. I have a clock or a watch. And if there's any questions or comments, I'll be happy to take them.
Are there any questions? Don?
What's the status in Germany?
Germany now is up till the time the French report was published, Germany was the worst of the places and probably will remain that way. Nothing had gone on nationally in Germany, but Germany is like the United States, is divided into a number of state governments. Every state government has a government-paid anti-cult official whose job is merely to put down new religious groups. And so it's been very, very active in Germany in the courts, particularly in Hamburg and in Frankfurt. Number of anti-group activities have been passed. A number of groups were driven out when they passed a law in the 80s disallowing homeschooling, which a number of the groups have their own parochial schools, and that cut those out. So it's been very, very active and very, very hostile. Hamburg is also the European headquarters for the Church of Scientology. And by far the most controversial group next to the Witnesses are the Scientologists. And they are the group that has been most active in defending themselves at every little juncture. So they have taken and have an amazing set of victories. They recently, there was a best-selling book attacking them. And they forced the publisher to take the book off the stands as libelous and won a nice settlement from the book. Of course, there are 100,000 copies of it out there now that were sold before it got pulled. But they pulled it, had to pull it from the stands. But up until this French report came out, we thought that Germany was going to be the battleground. And it may return to there if this wave of legislation goes the way in other countries that it did in France. But it's a nasty situation. Mormons are taking it on the chin there. And the authorities in Utah have been very slow to react to this, by the way. The Seventh-day Adventists have been taking it on the chin, and in spite of their history of religious liberty work here in the States, they are turning a deaf ear to what's going on to their pastors in Germany. The most recent cases have involved Pentecostal churches. Pentecostalism is gaining quite a stronghold in Germany, and there's been actions taken against some thriving Pentecostal groups. They are fighting back, I must say. So it's going to be an interesting situation.
Yes?
I realize you're Japan,
yes. Sure. Yeah, it's
just
about
a minute. I'm supposed to repeat the question. Oh. There's a new law in Japan, and you'd like, and he would like,
right,
a comment on that.
Right. The situation in Japan, it's hard to think how Japan's national consciousness was affected by the Aum action. I went to Japan about a month after the gassing. It took me 3 hours to get through the airport. From the time we left the airport until we embarked upon the plane to come home, we were followed by two policemen. It was a phenomenal situation. Even I got to where I could spot a Japanese policeman no matter what. You know, they all dressed the same. They all had the same little bag. It was funny. But their presence, they were all over. They put on more supplementary policemen in Japan last summer and through the fall than Los Angeles has policemen. And that's how it affected them. The Aum situation was on the front page of every paper for up through the end of the year. And I think still is, although instead of being three articles, it's down to one article now. The week we were there, Asahara's picture was everywhere. It was on the front page of three of the major magazines. It was in every train car, the whole situation. So out of this, there was some demand to do something, some way. And so one of the suggestions was some anti-cult legislation, anti-new religions legislation. Well, the Buddhists organized and kind of put that down because they knew who was going to get hurt by that the most. So what's happened is a compromise bill has been proposed and is going into effect. It's still going through the judicial process, but it's passed essentially, and there's nothing left to really block it. It is a bill that picks up much of this anti-cult propaganda, and interestingly enough, it applies only to religious groups that were founded since 1968 and have less than 100,000 members. Okay? So you see how it got narrowed down. But it's the kind of thing, it's very obvious what the rub is. And the rub are the Soka Gakkai. While it's aimed at the Aum is dead and gone and buried. And the other target is the Soka Gakkai. So it says things like, no government official may go to a meeting of a religious group in an official capacity. No government official can show favoritism to one religious group over another in any official things. No religious group can run anyone for public office. No person on the public dole can give contributions to a religious group. There's just a whole set of regulations. But the real the teeth in the idea has to do with proselytizing. It very clearly says if you talk to someone about your religion and they say no, and you go and talk to them again, we're going to come and get you. If someone is a member of your group and walks away and you go and try to convince them to come back, we're going to come and get you. Now that's where the teeth of the argument is. And so what they're trying to do is find some way to operationalize an understanding that these groups are brainwashing people, and that they are being obnoxious about their proselytizing activities. That law is going to go into effect, and it's going to be at least 10 years before anything can be done about it. The Aum trial, there are 200 people in jail for the Aum situation. The Aum trials are going to last for 5 years at least. And Asahara's trial itself, which has already started, will last 2 or 3 years. So,
yes.
You mean the Mormon Church?
Just
Mormon Church is not.
The question is, what is the church actually doing to combat this situation?
It's playing ostrich, and as as with a number of groups. I mean, the Mormon Church in most countries of Europe is not very strong, and it doesn't have a lot of resources, and it doesn't have the backing from Salt Lake. So its role in fighting this kind of situation and what could come down on it very easily is one of kind of taking a low profile and hoping that the times will pass. And experience has taught that sometimes that's the way it happens. We don't know who. Obviously, the government's not going to move against all 200 or 300 groups that they've listed, but they're going to move selectively against groups and as opportunity supplies them an issue. So many of the groups that are taking a low profile will survive and will survive in good stead and will be able to come out of it and say that's the way we did it. And of course, that's the way the Jews did it. And it worked for them for centuries, and then all of a sudden they got wiped out in a good part of Europe. But essentially nothing is the answer. Right.
Okay, wait a minute. The question was, give us some background on the sarin gas as with respect to the fact that it came from Russia.
Right. One of the things that came out within a week of the gassing was a report that there was some problems with calling the sarin. The reason it was called sarin is because in Asahara's documents, in his books, he says that at some point during this decade, his group is going to be attacked and with sarin, and that he specifically named sarin. So when the gas went off, some of the people who were familiar with this connected it. Oh, he talks about sarin. He's let out nerve gas. It must be sarin. It wasn't sarin. That came out about a week or two after the event, if you read the papers carefully, in Japan. It came out that it was something called tabum, which is another form of nerve gas that is peculiar. It's the form of nerve gas developed in Russia during World War II, and which large supplies were left at the end of World War II. It has different effects, and people who knew about nerve gas were quite aware of the fact that the symptoms that were being reported were not sarin symptoms. One of the problems that they had is that nerve gas is so volatile, it doesn't leave a residue. So, for example, they have the containers that the gas was kept in. But it is so volatile that there is not enough residue in those containers to tell what those containers held. So one of the problems they have with the court case is there's no physical evidence. It must all be done on reports. There are no nerve gas supplies that have been found, only some materials which possibly could be used to make it. We are now pretty aware of what happened in Japan is that during the 1980s, Asahara, in his own quest for ultimate psychic superiority, took a lot of ecstasy and several other mind-altering drugs. He blew his circuits out. Not only is Asahara legally blind, but he is not ill in the sense he doesn't have a disease. What he's got is a nerve degeneration condition that's caused by taking all these drugs. It was the hope of some of the medical leaders in the group that they could synthesize some nerve gas, nerve gas production is a five-step process, and it only gets dangerous at the fifth step. It gets very dangerous at the fifth step. And so they were going to try to make small quantities up to the fourth step and use it as medicine and see if they could reverse the damage done to Asahara's body. But once they had that capability, then there was the possibility of going on to the next step. It appears that they did that they got some original small quantity of tabum from the KGB agent, probably from a KGB agent, but they got it in Russia, and that's the logical place they would have gotten it. They brought it back to Japan and then started trying to synthesize it. They had only one facility that they could do that with, and it's a small facility that looks like a telephone booth. It's about that big, and you stick hands into it, and you can make, you know, a cupful. That's all you can synthesize in that kind of space. And it appears that they were working on synthesizing some of this nerve gas to use as a medicine. And that's why they had it. And so when the opportunity came for them to... the police were after them because of another murder. Some of the leaders had murdered a lawyer back in 1989, and they were slowly tracking the murder to them. And the reason for the nerve gas incident in Tokyo was to get the police interested in something else and get them off their back. It had nothing to do with anything so lofty as theological speculation.
Yes.
It sounds like this legislation may be largely politically motivated and has nothing to do with the religion.
It's totally politically motivated. It's to reestablish public confidence in the government and in the safety of Tokyo. The safety of Tokyo streets is a major item at issue. You can walk Tokyo streets any time of night, no crime. There's no street crime in Tokyo, and that's the problem they have. That's how it affected the psyche so much.
In Europe, too, I think.
Yeah. Well, in Europe, yes, but in Tokyo, that's one of their badges of honor. I mean, you know, here, come to L.A., we treat you like a king. But you go to Tokyo, they do you a little better.
Okay, we're going to have to quit now. The time is up. Thank you very much.